Oh, shalom, shalom, my friends. This is your old pal, Rabbi Sol Solomon, here on the Dave's Gone By radio program of the air. I'm going to name some movie titles, and you're going to have instant images in your heads of these titles. Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, Fresh Horses, Pretty in Pink, and let's not forget the John Cassavetes version of The Tempest. All of these films involved our guest in the neighborhood today, the delightful Molly Ringwald. She is not just an actress, not just an author, but she is also a singer, a musician. She is the daughter of a jazz musician and has followed now in her father's footsteps. But without more ado, let us talk to the very, very red-headed Molly Ringwald, who is on the phone with us. Shalom, Molly!
Shalom!
Oh, good. Now, one thing that did surprise me, because your last name sounds a little bit Jewish, you're not remotely Jewish.
I'm not Jewish. I feel like I should be, and perhaps I was once upon a time. I have to do more genealogy research, but as far as I know, I'm not Jewish.
But what's interesting is that sometimes you get cast that way. Like, you were in an off-Broadway comedy about 10 years ago called Modern Orthodox, playing a woman named Hannah Ziegelstein. So
that's right. I was.
Did you have to do a lot of research for that?
You know, I don't feel like I really did have to do that much research because, you know, most of my friends are Jewish, and I feel like I've grown around that my entire life. So my character was not religious at all. She was very much against all that, which is sort of a little bit about, you know, the themes of the play, you know, what does it mean to be Jewish today and all of the different kinds of Judaism. So, you know, it was a fantastic play. But no, I didn't really feel like I did have to do that much research.
Okay. Now, let's talk about, because obviously people know you from the John Hughes films and from some other things, but what I would love to know is a role or two that you played either on film or on TV that people might not know about that you are most proud of or that people should seek out.
You know, it's kind of hard because I think some of the work that I've been most proud of is in the theater, on stage. Sally Bowles in Cabaret.
Oh, my goodness. Speaking of, she isn't Jewish, but the show kind of is.
Yeah, well, it definitely deals with, it's pre-Hitler and, the Weimar Republic and, you know. Yeah, it's a fantastic play. So that was one of my favorite characters, I think. I did that for about a year. And also I did a movie that actually people can seek out. It's probably not that easy to find, but it was a French movie that I did called Enfant de Salaud.
Oh.
Which means Children of a Bastard in French.
Oh my God! Oi, the language! I'm kidding.
That was a fantastic. I was very proud of that because I acted entirely in French, which was not the easiest thing to do because I basically learned French as an adult.
Well, weren't you living in France for a very long time?
I was living there for on and off for about 10 years, yeah.
Ah, okay. So I assume you were fluent-ish by the time. Within 5 years or so, or no?
You know, fluent is one of those words that, you know, I don't know if I'll ever consider myself completely fluent. I mean, I don't speak. I didn't grow up in a bilingual house. I really had to learn it as an adult. But I think I did a pretty good job.
Molly, believe it or not, the technical difficulty we're having at the moment is not on our end. Are you on a cell?
Yeah, I am on a cell, and unfortunately, it's the only phone that I have.
Okay, because sometimes you're fine, and other times you're right, okay, like this, which
right,
is
right.
Difficult.
Let me see if I can find another place in the house that might have better service.
Yeah, maybe with a skylight or something, or two tin cans and a string could possibly work there. I will hold, and this is fine. We're talking with Molly Ringwald, by the way. We're half talking with her. We're getting about half of what she's saying here in the neighborhood.
I'm walking outside, so maybe it'll be better.
Okay. Oh, yeah, get some of those sun rays to carry your vocal cords there.
Some vitamin D. How's this?
Sounds a lot better than it was before. Okay. Good. I apologize for this, but folks at home, if you knew what we've had to go through to get this interview over the past week or so. So we're thrilled that we even have any of your words coming through. So,
okay, here I am.
Okay, seems a little better. Now, where were we? Roles that people could see you. You were talking about a TV thing. One of your favorite? Yeah.
Talking about a French movie that I did called Enfant Fellow, that was directed by a French film director named Tony Marshall, or Tony Marshall in French. And I'm really proud of that because I had never acted in another language before. And, you know, it's really different. You know, the movie that I was doing was with a lot of comedic actors, and my ability to improvise in a foreign language, you know, is if I could think of 5 different words or 10 different words in English, I could maybe think of one other word in French. So, you know, it was really challenging, but I'm really proud of it. So
that's interesting.
I would say that those are the 2 parts that I'm probably the most proud of.
So when you were trying to do scenes in this different language, because I've done a little bit of horrible acting myself, but did you have to sort of think of an English word and then rephrase it, or did you have a French translator and then you were kind of phonetically doing it, or what was the process?
No, I was actually thinking in French, which is really kind of, for me, it's the only way. I don't know that I could ever act phonetically. I mean, I know some people do, but to me, I really have to understand what I'm saying. So I would say about 3 months before I just stopped speaking English altogether. I wouldn't even call my family. Everybody in France had to speak to me in French. And so it really got to where I was thinking in French. I just, my vocabulary in French is just, you know, it's limited. So it was just a little bit harder to improvise, but I worked really hard on it.
What brought you back from France to America?
I feel like I missed America. You know, I kind of went to France. I didn't know that I was going to stay. I just went there and sort of fell in love with Paris, and I fell in love with a man, and I really, really wanted to learn how to speak French and to work in that language. And then once I did, I sort of felt like I missed acting in English. You know, I thought, well, I can do this in French, but I can act, you know, probably a lot better in English. And I just missed the country, and I missed my friends and my family. And so it was sort of time to come back.
And certainly the right decision. I mean, you're happy to be back. You're happy to, you can visit France whenever you want, but now you're back on the good old USA.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I consider myself, you know, very American. And my life is here. My family's here.
Of course, if a Republican takes office, you might have to move back to France or Canada or somewhere. But we'll see.
Yeah. I know. I think I actually said I was just in Canada a couple of days ago, and I think I actually said that if Trump becomes president, I'm going to move to Canada. Which I don't know. You know if that's realistic or not. I'm sure I'm not the only one who feels this way. But then part of me thinks, you know, you can't really leave your country when it's in bad shape. You know, that's kind of like the time that you should stay.
If you could, all Americans would have spent the last 30 out of the 40 years in a foreign country. Kind of got to stick it through, you know?
Yeah, I think we need to stay, and you need to fight for what you believe in.
And quite honestly, if Trump does get elected, Canada will be annexed to the United States within 3 years.
Yes.
So it would be pointless to move there anyway. We're talking with the delightful Molly Ringwald. We've been talking about her acting. Let's move over now, though, to the musical side of Molly, because that's what she has been concentrating on quite a bit for the past year or two or three. She has an album that you can buy, and you can go see her on Mother's Day at Asbury Park. It's called the House of Independence is where she's playing. Now, please explain to the folks that you grew up with music, not just on a phonograph, but physically from your own father.
That's right. My father is a jazz musician. He's a little bit more, well, he's a lot more traditional jazz. And even though I'm sort of Great American Songbook, it's still old. It's not as old-timey as my dad's music.
Okay.
But I did, I mean, he raised me on a steady diet of Louis Armstrong and Vic Spiderbeck and Sidney Bechet and Bessie Smith. And, you know, that's sort of the musical education that I grew up with. And then I kind of, went a little bit more modern with my band. But yeah, it really feels like it's sort of coming back to my roots.
Now, I read, and forgive me if this is incorrect, but your father is blind. Am I right about this?
Yes, that's correct.
And he was all through your growing up. He was born that way, or he lost his sight, or what?
Yeah, he was born legally blind, and then by the time he was, I think, 10 or 12, it went away entirely. So he's completely without sight.
Was growing up with that, did you feel different from your classmates or cohorts? Was your lifestyle somehow different, or was it completely normal to you because that's all you knew?
Yeah, I think the latter. It was all I knew. I felt more different, to be honest, that he was a musician and he kept different hours than other dads. He worked at night, and there weren't that many kids that I knew who grew up in that sort of musical environment. So that to me, in suburban Sacramento in the 70s, that really kind of felt more different to me than him being without sight. And my dad is so incredibly competent in every way and always has been that it never really seemed like any kind of disability to me. It was just, it was just him. It was just part of his personality almost.
What's his instrument, by the way?
He plays several, but his main instrument is piano.
Now, did you take instruments or just vocal since you grew up with all that music?
All of us, me, my brother, and my sister, we all took piano at some point. And I think I probably went the longest, but I gave it up, I think, around 10 or 12. And it's actually one of my biggest regrets.
Hmm. I mean, you can still, I assume, pluck out chords and do a little bit, but you won't be concert level piano at this point.
No, and I don't even know how many chords I can plunk out. I really gave it up and didn't come back to it. And I wish I did. But it's hard. I didn't want to practice, which is the same issue that I have right now with my kids. I've given them all piano lessons. They're all incredibly talented, and they don't want to practice.
I've been there, done that on the clarinet, quite honest, and the kazoo, which is interesting because I could have learned that one pretty quickly. But let me ask you, what was the impetus of not just listening to your dad's music or doing just stuff for you for fun, but of saying, hey, I want to put out an album, I want to go to concerts, I want to be a vocalist in the standards, American standards jazz tradition? What gave you the kick in the tuchus to do that?
It was really sort of an organic process. It was not something that I necessarily thought that I would do. It was something in the back of my mind. I always wanted to put a band together and just kind of do it as a little side project. And I never found a pianist that
What was that word? A pianist, I think.
Pianist.
Because you were married already two times. You found the other thing. Okay, yes?
Piano player. I never found somebody other than my father that I really felt comfortable working with, even though there's so many great ones out there, I just never found it, and I was also sort of busy with, other projects.
Of course.
And then I was doing that play, Modern Orthodox, and Peter Smith was understudying the role of Jason Biggs and Craig Bierko, who were the two actors in the play. And about, I don't know, we were almost at the end of the production when, at a cast party, Peter sat down at this beautiful Steinway and played jazz. And I was just bowled over, and I couldn't believe that we had worked together all that time and we didn't know that we shared this this thing. So I decided right then that I wanted to start working with him. And then he moved to Los Angeles, and then this was in New York. So
right, yeah.
And my hopes were dashed. And I forgot about it, and then I moved to L.A. a couple years later, and he was the first person I called. And so we really started to work together in earnest in 2008. And then it was just kind of like one thing led to another. We started working together, and then we added musicians, and then we started to do gigs, and then we decided to do the album, and it was just like one thing led to another, and before I knew it, I was on tour.
Wow. And let me ask you, there's so many songs in the American songbook, as it were, the things that everyone from Ella Fitzgerald would have covered to, you know, Broadway people doing Rodgers and Hart or Rodgers and Hammerstein. How do you choose 10 songs for an album as opposed to the others? Do you wade through 100 and whittle them down to 10? What's the choice making involved?
You know, it's usually just a song that I have loved over the years, that I've heard a lot, that I've listened to a lot. You know, it's something about the lyrics speaks to me. And then another consideration was if we really gel together as a band. You know, there's certain songs that I love that I really want to sing, but it just doesn't come together in the way that I want it to. And so I think with all of those considerations, we ended up with the songs that we ended up with. And then we just recorded a new album about a month and a half ago that we're mixing now, that hopefully will be out by the fall, and that's going to be a live album.
Oh.
And again, it was songs that, you know, we've done on tour. You know, I've really grown so much as an artist, as a singer, so much since I did the first album.
In what?
It's hard not to look back and sort of be critical of the first album, but you know, that's just the nature of it. As you go along, you sort of grow, and I've become more confident. I've become, you know, more improvisational, a lot looser, and we've also just grown together as a group. You know, I think we're much tighter, and you know, it's exciting.
Do you have
the journey continues?
Well, I assume you did when you were doing Broadway and cabaret, but do you have a vocal coach? Do you do vocal exercises? Do you take voice lessons?
I had a vocal coach when I was in cabaret, just to, you know, keep my voice in shape, and I think I was actually the only Sally Bowles that never lost my voice.
Oh.
So I kept it very, you know, I really worked on keeping my voice strong, and then I worked with a wonderful vocalist named Sarah Gazarek, who's a jazz vocalist. And that's completely different. I mean, jazz singing is completely different than Broadway singing. And I actually am seeking out a new person, because I feel like no matter what, there's always improvement, and there's always things to learn. And it's exciting to me to continue to grow, you know, as an artist. And not just as a singer, but I'm also a writer, so I'm you know, working on that as well.
Oh, well, we should also remind people that they can buy the book that you wrote, When It Happens to You, A Novel in Stories, that was published by HarperCollins back in 2012. It got some really good reviews, if you want to read them on Amazon or the places where you can buy the book. So are you writing more stories or a novel or a what?
I'm working on a novel, but you know, because my time is somewhat limited, you know, I'm the mother of three, and I have these other careers, I find that finding the time actually to write is one of my biggest challenges. So right now I'm working on short stories, just because that's, you know, a little bit like Raymond Carver. I think Raymond Carver was a short story writer because he had a family, and he didn't have that much time along with his day job as well. And I feel like it's a little bit of my situation as well.
Well, and you mentioned the family there. I have 21 and a half beautiful children. Well, they're not all beautiful, but you have three, including a pair of twins. And I'm wondering, do you see that weird twin thing sometimes? Does one feel the other's pain? Do you sometimes have that kind of, oh, wow, they're connected in a way that other children aren't necessarily?
Yeah, absolutely. I never thought that I would have twins. They're not identical, you know, they're fraternal, and it's a boy and a girl. But I have to say, having twins and watching them grow up next to each other, it makes you feel really bad that you're not a twin.
Oh!
You know? Hmm. It makes me feel like they have something that really only twins experience. I mean, they're so connected, they're really best friends. really do feel like they feel each other's pain. You know, if one of them gets chewed out for something, the other one cries. It's the craziest thing.
Now, if your children, when they grow up a bit, decide, oh, I want to be in the showbiz in some form or other, will you encourage that? Or would you be happy about it? What advice would you give them?
You know, my husband and I have a rule, well, definitely a rule, that my kids cannot be professional until they're older. It's not something that I want them to do while they're going to school. I want them to finish college, or at least get
well,
to age, and decide whether or not it's something that's for them. And if at that point they decide that they want to go into acting, you know, yeah, I'll support them, I'll encourage them. But it's just not something that I want to deal with until they're that age.
Professionally, but if they wanted to take acting classes or things like that in high school and college, you would be okay with that.
Oh, absolutely. I think acting is fantastic for kids. I think it's a wonderful way to express themselves creatively. It's a way to teach social skills. It's fun. I think it's a fantastic thing to do. I recommend that everyone have their kids act. You know, I really think that acting itself is wonderful, and learning theater and learning the skills are really important. I just don't want them to be professional until they're older.
No, that I get. Now you mentioned your husband. Your first husband was French. Your second husband is a Greek fellow. Did you meet him in Greece, or where did you meet him?
No, we met in New York City.
Oh, okay, cool. And then what does he do?
He's a writer and an editor.
A film editor.
He took a couple of years off and went to business school, went to Stanford Business School. So he does a lot of things, but mostly he's a writer and an editor.
That's cool. So if you have to tour and things like that, he can look after the kids. I mean, it works out with your schedules the way actors and performers have to work things out.
You know, every day feels like a victory in terms of, you know, childcare and who gets to, you know, do what. It's, you know, I can't say that my job is so erratic and it's so feast or famine, and I never know exactly where I'm going to be. So, you know, we're very flexible with each other in terms of, you know, who does what, but it's definitely a partnership. And every day at the end of the day, we think, okay, we pulled that day off.
Now, we have a few more minutes with the delightful Molly Ringwald. And one of the things that we love to do and get in interviews is anecdotes, is memories, is little stories, things that you remember from the people that you've worked with, especially in movies and TV things. For example, you were in a film called Teaching Mrs. Tingle, which sounds like it should be porn, but it's not. And Helen Mirren was in it. Do you have a Helen Mirren memory?
You know, I didn't work with her that much, but the days that I did work with her, I think I've never worked with someone lovelier. I mean, she was so nice and so easy to talk to, and absolutely lovely. I don't know if I have a specific anecdote, but I really enjoyed the time that I spent with her.
Okay, now speaking of English people and high-level English people, there was a 1990 movie that you did called Strike It Rich that even had John Gielgud in it. Do you remember him?
Yes, I do. And I can tell you something about him that was amazing. He told me when we did a scene together that I reminded him of Marilyn Monroe.
Wow.
He knew, which I think was like the biggest compliment, the biggest, like, ego boost that I think anyone has ever given me. I mean, to be told by Sir John Gielgud that you resemble Marilyn Monroe, I think I've never forgotten it.
All right.
And I don't, for the record, I don't really think that I look like Marilyn Monroe, but just to be told that, you know, was pretty amazing.
And you hope that he meant as far as resembled and not that he expected you to have sex with a Kennedy and then die suicidally. That would
be maybe
bad.
Maybe he was referring to that. I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Now, invariably, we get to the Brat Pack anecdotes, which you kind of were part of, but you wanted to distance yourself from. Any memories of doing the movies with John Hughes, maybe of him as a director or some of your co-stars. Let it flow.
he was amazing. John Hughes was, he was so original and, and has managed to pull off something that I don't think anybody did before or since, which is, make a movie about teenagers that was intelligent, that was real, that was both funny and moving. And I think it's one of the reasons why those movies continue to resonate with audiences is that there's nothing else like them,
And if you want to say that they still resonate today, I'm sure you've seen on TV, there's a commercial now for, I think, a phone, Verizon or something, with Anthony Michael Hall. And there you are. Have you seen it?
I actually haven't seen the commercial, but I know it exists because they had to get my permission to use the clip.
Yeah, they say, oh, here's the movie where Anthony Michael Hall gets rejected by the girl. Here's the one where he likes the girl. Here's another one where he invents a girl. And in two of those movies, you're the girl. The last one is Kelly LeBrock, so they probably had to get her permission too. But yeah, I mean, those movies, people still, they are iconic in a way.
They definitely are. And, I recently showed my my daughter, my eldest daughter, The Breakfast Club. And it was just a wild experience. And I feel like it was the closest that I've come to actually experiencing the movie the way that everybody else did, the way the teenagers did, because I think these movies spoke to teenagers so much at the time, and then to subsequent generations, it's almost like a touchstone that the kids have, because everyone has to go through high school, everyone has to go through that experience, and nothing really changes that much. But I didn't have those movies as a touchstone because I was in them. My experience was completely different. But I think showing them to my daughter was the closest I came to actually sort of getting that feeling of experiencing them, the way that everyone else did.
But even now, all these years later, could you watch that movie and watch a scene that you were in and see it as a scene, or did you still, in your head, it's like, oh, I remember what happened after they yelled cut, or I remember how many times we had to retake that, or so-and-so did something really funny, or could you just watch the scene?
I think it's a little bit of both. It feels a little bit like looking at, baby pictures of myself. It's hard to explain. I mean, there's so much that goes through my head at the time, as I'm watching it, but there's moments where I just get completely caught up in the movie because it's a really good movie, and I kind of forget everything else, and I just get completely caught up in the characters, and of course, the last time that I watched it, I was watching it with Matilda, and I was watching her reaction, and I was so nervous that she wasn't going to like it, or she was going to text her friends while she was watching it, so I was really kind of on edge a little bit watching her, and it was just a mind-blowing experience for me.
How old is she, by the way? You say you're your oldest.
But... Now she's going to be 13 in October, and we watched it a couple years ago, which is actually, I think, too young to watch.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is all of her friends had already seen it, and she would go to slumber parties, and that movie would be on the list of movies that people wanted to watch. And so she sort of lobbied to watch this movie, and she said she didn't want to watch it without me. She wanted to watch it the first time before she watched it with her friends, and so that's what we did.
That is very cool. I mean, you mentioned that you don't want your kids being professional actor people before a certain age. Do you feel that you were somehow deprived of a teenhood because you started acting in those movies? Or you could still be a teenager, but you had to feel you were a role model and all that.
Well, obviously my experience was different than, all other teenagers. And I do feel like, having gone through it myself, I feel like it's really difficult. It is a business. They don't, it's show business.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that that kids, it's not the healthiest environment. And I feel like I sort of survived and I navigated it, but I think it's just really difficult. You always want the best for your kids. And like having gone through it myself, I think you know, why put them in a position where they have to sort of overcome and they have to, like, make the transition to adult actress, and they're going to be around, you know, people that are not necessarily the greatest influencers, you know. So, you know, that's just my feeling. And, you know, I get a lot of pushback from my daughter on that, because obviously she's very interested in acting and show business and everything. But it's just something that I believe is the right way to go at this point.
Well, it has been certainly the right way to go for us to talk with the lovely Molly Ringwald. If you want to find out, first of all, about her concert on May 8th, Mother's Day, in Asbury Park, New Jersey. Finally, New Jersey is doing something good. It's May 8th, Mother's Day. She's doing two concerts that night at the House of Independence. For information about that, also about her CD and her upcoming new CD in the next couple of months, and her book, When It Happens to You, A Novel in Stories, all of that you can find out about at IamMollyRingwald.com. IamMollyRingwald.com. That's her website, and you can find out all about that. And one more question for you, and I'm sure it's the one you get every day from every media outlet, but gotta ask it. How often are you in touch with your Brat Pack cohorts, if at all?
You know, from time to time, usually, you know, some sort of event that's honoring John Hughes, or, you know, I just hung out with Allie at South by Southwest for the 30-year anniversary. But, you know, it's a movie that we made, you know, 30 years ago, and we spent 3 months together. And, you know, I will say that I feel inextricably linked to these people because of this movie, but still, you know, life goes on. We all have our you know, we've all gone in different directions.
Cool. That makes sense. I mean, the movie resonates for people in a different way than the people who were in it. For you, for some of you, it was just another acting assignment. And when you were done, you did 10 more movies after that. How come nobody asks, hey, what happened to the people who did Lily Dale off Broadway in 1987? I mean, people just don't ask that, you know? So, last question.
I actually am still friends with that actor that was with me in Lucky Bailey's
movie. Really? And maybe Hallie Foote is, you contact her once in a while. Horton no longer, unfortunately. But and very, very, very last question, I promise, for Molly Ringwald is, do you have an all-time favorite song? And it can be jazz, swing, or it can be pop, whatever, but all-time favorite song.
You know, I don't really think that I have an all-time favorite song. I have songs that I love, you know, at one point, and then, you know, and then I move on to another song. So it's actually hard to pick, you know, my absolute favorite song.
All right, well, what's on your iPod now? I'll switch the question up. What are you listening to of other people?
So I'll tell you this. I'll give you, like, my all-time favorite musical. West Side Story.
Ah, well.
The score to West Side, I Feel Pretty in my set, but I think that's the score that I think just gives me chills every time I listen to it. And it's a score that I've loved since I was a little kid. Like, I used to tap dance in the garage with my brother to, you know, the Jet song. And, you know, it's just a score that just carries me through years, and I never get sick of it. It's one of those, you know, I think the combination of Sondheim and Bernstein was just, you know, there's just nothing better than that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Broadway people would agree with you there. I mean, it's generally on the short list of five favorite musicals of anybody who knows anything about musicals. It's
So,
you have good taste. Good to know.
Thank you.
And you folks listening at home, have the good taste to go to New Jersey on Mother's Day evening at the House of Independence to see Molly Ringwald. Remember, her website is IamMollyRingwald.com. I am not Molly Ringwald. I am Rabbi Sal Solomon. She is Molly, and we are so grateful that she has spent some time with us today. I wish you much more success with all the facets of your creativity, the writing, the musicianship, the vocaling, and the acting. So is there anything, I forgot to ask, is there anything we should be looking out for as a TV thing or a movie thing coming out in the next couple of months with you in it?
There's a series that's called Raising Expectations, the one that I did in Canada that's premiering actually on Mother's Day in Canada. And and then they'll decide where they're going to sell it in the state. So, you know, that's coming up. And then, of course, my live album, Live at Birdland, is another project. And I'm also in a movie with James Franco and Christian Slater called King Cobra that that people should watch out for as well, that just premiered at the Tribeca Film Fest.
Oh, so you are keeping busy with a whole bunch of things. That's wonderful. And we will keep apprised and our eyes on the lovely Molly Ringwald. Thank you, thank you. Much continued success. And we hope you don't have to move to Canada.
Me too.
Shalom to you.
Shalom.